What do you remember from yesterday's class, which was entitled The Explanation of the Vedic Path? Indirect. Well, because if you translate that as esoteric, then he likes mysterious things. Of course, he's the mystery of everything. But as far as I understand, the actual intended meaning of what he likes is not to speak so directly, but everything is implied and indirect. So that way the people who have the adhikara can understand, and the people who don't have the adhikara don't understand. And yet the same thing is being spoken. So in that way he can speak for everyone and satisfy everyone at the same time. But yes, it's a wonderful concept. Which verse is that again?
35.
Excuse me?
35.
35. Krishna likes Parokshavad. It's more indirect. And there's more rasa in it, actually, in Parokshavad. Tell me again the verse. Just like if you come to my house and I want to, and I know that you're hungry, and you want something to eat, so I say to you, "Would you like something to eat?" And you know there's nothing; they'll be cooking. So what will you say? No. I won't take anything to eat. So instead of saying, "Would you like something to eat?" you say, "I'm so hungry and I need to cook something right now because I'm so hungry. You'll also take something?" "Oh yes, I'll take something." So there's more rasa in it in that way. The cowherd boys, when they were saying, "We're so hungry, we've been out in the forest, we are near Talavan," actually near Govardhan, and "we're so hungry, we haven't eaten anything all day, and can you smell those fruits from in the tall fruits that have fallen to the ground?" So one may ask the question, well, everything is done for Krishna, so why are the cowherd boys saying, "We're so hungry"? Because the answer is given that it's not, is they know that Krishna is hungry. They know that Krishna is hungry. So they say, "Oh, Krishna, we are so hungry. Let us get some of those fruits." Actually, they're thinking of Krishna. So it's more, it's indirect and more subtle. And this is, and therefore it's very good for nourishing rasa. And this is so much a part of the Indian culture, the Veda culture. There's nothing direct, but everything is so much more indirect. And once you catch how indirect it is and how subtle it is and how sweeter it is, then, how to say it politely, the Western culture appears very, very gross, which is good for business, but it's not as subtle, and there's less rasa in it.
Also, there are some concepts which die when expressed. So they can only be implied.
I won't ask you which concepts, because then you'll express them and they'll die.
This is this famous shloka by Sri Vishwanath.
In Prem Samput.
Yeah. That love, when expressed, goes out like a candle in the wind. So the same way when we speak about it, when it comes out from our mouth, it loses it, it evaporates.
And therefore Narottama Das Thakur in Prem Bhakti Chandrika says, don't go speaking about what you have attained in your bhajan here and there, because you will lose it like that. In the same way, one isn't supposed to say, we had a big japa retreat and I chanted so many rounds, and say, "I've chanted this number of rounds." Because somewhere it is said, or at least in the amongst the devotees, they say when you tell people how many rounds you've chanted, you're giving them all, you're distributing those rounds to everyone else. So unless you're very generous and want to chant for others. I had one experience of Prabhupada when he did something like that with me, and it was so sweet at the time the way he did it, because I had given him a gold ring when he was in Hong Kong, and then we went to Japan, and Sudama Prabhu was massaging Prabhupada, and I was the only one there. So Prabhupada was getting massaged. And he saw that, Sudama saw that he had a new ring on. So Sudama said to Prabhupada, "Oh, you have a new ring, Prabhupada. Where did you get it? Who gave it to you?" And Prabhupada just looked at me and said, "Oh, someone." Just made it so intimate and personal and private. They're all someone. So one devotee really liked that story, so he told it to so many of his American friends, and they all said, "I don't understand. What's so funny about that?" "I don't get it." But I got it when I was sitting next to him. It was just so much more intimate and personal because he did it like that. Did you want to say something, Abba?
How does it work in reverse? Sometimes you want to please somebody, but sometimes maybe you don't want to reveal something to somebody when they're actually inquiring. Is that also a question in an indirect way?
Well, obviously, it depends on the circumstance. If you're stopped by a policeman when you're speeding, and he asks you, "What's your name?" and you don't want to reveal it, you want to explain it in an indirect way. So that might not go over very well. But if you would be a little less indirect and a little more direct, and I might be able to understand a little more.
Maybe asking something.
Like, what's an example?
Going to be negative. So, is it better to be indirect?
Well, it depends. It depends who it is. Sometimes Prabhupada was very direct when he wanted to tell you something. He was very direct, very strong. So everything should be done out of affection. That's the basis of interactions. And then sometimes that will call demand being direct, and sometimes indirect.
In the temple, they announce donations and they give.
Oh, now I'm going to be. Should I be direct or indirect in my reply? Any other questions? But we don't want to mix what goes on locally with, we're talking about principles here. So let the devotees decide how they want to do things. But let me ask you a question. Do you want them to announce your name when you give a donation?
Not really, but they do all the paperwork in the donation office.
No, but I'm asking, when you give a donation, do you want them to announce your name?
No.
So then you tell them, "I'm giving this anonymously, Prabhu. Please don't say my name." And that's the most important thing we should worry about, ourselves. So if you feel that way, then you tell them that. And actually, when giving donations, there are many, many subtleties involved. That's one of them. There's in some religious traditions, they have different gradations of donations, and anonymous is considered a higher grade. And then when you give anonymously something of your money, thinking I'm giving some of my money, that's on one level. And then when you give all of your money, that's on another level. And then when you think, this isn't my money at all, it's been placed in my hands by Krishna, let me use it wisely in his service because it's his money, that's on a still higher level. And this is how the Kshatriyas, when they say to the Brahmins, you know, we don't have anything to give you in charity. We're supposed to give you charity, but we're in a difficult situation because we are just governing on your behalf. This kingdom is yours, so, and everything belongs to you, so what can we give you in charity? How can we give the owner of something, give him something that he already owns? So, but that there's rasa involved in it. So if you want to give something to Krishna, you want it to be you want, you're giving it for his pleasure. When that's the dominant thing in your mind, this is for your pleasure, Krishna, then the fact that other people are going to be going like this, I mean just mechanically anyway, but you're going like this, that might interfere with your very private gift to Krishna. So these things have to be considered.
I've noticed that sometimes when we preach or teach about some realizations, with time they tend to sort of wear off, which seems to be connected with this.
But time tends to wear them off anyway. But your point is speaking about them may make them wear off even more quickly.
So how do you preach some things are part of preaching?
But who's the center when you're preaching?
Srila Prabhupada.
And compassion. So if you give in charity and you don't have what you just gave away, then be satisfied and know that Krishna will give you more. He'll give you more and deeper. But don't be afraid of giving away in charity in the appropriate settings that which you have gained by the grace of Krishna, because this is one of the essential messages of the seventh chapter of Adi Lila about the Panchatattva, Chaitanya and five features, that the fruit increases when we give it away. So we should be very generous. But it's think of it like charity. That here I've somehow or another, due to God's grace or whatever little work I put in, this gift has been given to me. Here, please take it. I'm giving it to you. That's what really preaching is. It's not a mechanical process of trying to convert someone or to change someone like that. It's really, preaching is when a Vaishnava opens his heart and he shares with others the wealth that he has collected through the internal energy. It's a sharing of the internal energy that he's collected. So that's how it should be seen, and you should be. I don't want to say fearless, but I think the proper word is generous, very generous-hearted. I mean, when I say you, I mean. And fearless too, like that. Also, that famous pastime of Ramanujacharya, when he, after receiving the Diksha Mantra, he gave it to others, and his Guru Maharaj was furious and said, "These things, you lose the potency when it is spoken out loud and shared, and you'll lose the potency and you have to go to hell." And his mood was that to help these people, if I have to suffer some, I'm willing to take that. So I'm willing to take the loss. But yet we know there's no loss. Because Krishna is an ocean of benedictions, an ocean of realizations. There's no lack. There's anandam buddhi vardhanam, an ever increasing ocean. So. Okay, now to the Bhagavatam. So the conclusion of the last chapter, more or less, is harmonious with the conclusions of all the chapters. It was describing the Vedic path. And the essence of the Vedic path is to bring one to Krishna. So in the 43rd verse, that conclusion is expressed by the Lord Himself. I am the ritualistic sacrifice enjoined by the Vedas. And I am the worshipable deity. It is me. It is me who is the essence of the sacrifice. And I am the deity that is being worshipped by those sacrifices. Yajna Vai Vishnu. It is I who am presented as various philosophical hypotheses. And it is I alone who am then refuted by philosophical analysis. The transcendental sound vibration thus establishes me as the essential meaning of all the Vedic knowledge. The Vedas, elaborately analyzing all material duality as nothing but my illusory potency, ultimately completely negate this duality and achieve their own satisfaction. So, in other words, that it's that there is the essence of the Vedic path, is the Lord of the Vedic path, is Krishna. Vedescha savar aham eva vedyo. Now, the Vedic path teaches us how to wind our way. In other words, let's say if the universe is a chetra, or we have heard in the Bhagavad Gita and also in the early chapters of this canto that it's like a tree. Material existence is like a tree, or one can say it's a field of activities for a conditioned soul that he can wander on or use this field of activity so he can achieve the most wonderful situation. That is the actual value of the material world, that the temporary can be used to achieve the eternal. Tarapadruvamartadam. Now, the Vedas, so here is the universe, and the Vedas are like the instructions that come with the universe, or the documentation, we can say, that comes along with the universe. Here is the form, and here are the instructions or the documentation on how to use it. How to use it to do what? Well, if you want this, if you want to move to the top of the tree of the universe, is there a computer game like this? You know, the universe? No, not yet. But and you can get this if you perform this type of a piety. But it's the basic principle. You perform the whole virtual computer realm. You know, you perform this type of a piety, you gain these credits, and then you get more power. So if you do this kind of a thing, you can move up and get this type of pleasure and this type of pleasure. You can even elevate yourself to Brahmaloka.
Muslims have a table game like that.
Yeah.
With dice. With game breakers and sins and promotions.
What's the winning position? So the Vedas are the documentation for this whole game of universal within the universe existence. But the real winner is the one who gets out, who wakes up from the game, who throws away the board, throws away the dice, and gets on with his real life, which happens to be his relationship with Krishna. So that's what Krishna is really concluding. He goes over the whole Vedic system, which again is the documentation for the universe, how to get what you want from the universe, and then you move on to go beyond it, which is Krishna, to gain him, to gain his association, to gain his service. So the next chapter is going to describe, as we have heard quite a few times before, actually, and I believe that there's even perhaps even one more time after this where it's going to be described, the universe itself, its components. Because there are different people in this world. There are some people who like to drive cars, and there are other people who like to dealing with cars. No, okay, there's people who like to drive, but there's other people who like to take them apart. I remember when I was in high school, in every high school, I think, there's a group of kids who really shouldn't be in school at all, who just like to take apart cars and put them together. At least that was like that in Russia. Is it like that too? Not in India, I think.
I used to do that with watches.
Well, okay, there are some people who like to tell time with watches and other people like to take them apart. I used to have this one music box that I used to take apart, but every time I put it back together, there were extra pieces. I never could quite get it right. So some people like to take the car apart and see how it fits together and what are the component pieces and things like that. So as with cars, so also with the universe. So the elements or the essential foundational ingredients of the universe of material creation will now be described. So Krishna, Uddhava inquired, "My dear Lord, O Master of the universe," you're the Master of the universe, "how many different elements of creation have been enumerated by the great sages? I've heard you personally describe a total of 28. God, the jiva soul, the mahatattva, false ego, 5 gross elements, the 10 senses, the mind, and the 5 subtle objects of perception, tanmatras, and the 3 modes of nature. But some authorities say that there are 26 elements, while others cite 25, or else 7, 9, 6, 4, or 11. And even others say that there are 17, 16, or 13. What did each of these sages have in mind when he calculated the creative elements in such different ways? O Supreme Eternal, kindly explain this to me." So here is another situation where there are different sages have different opinions. Now in the 14th chapter of the 11th canto, somewhat a different situation has been described, where in the 14th chapter there are different philosophies. And where does anyone remember where Krishna said these different philosophies came from? The 3 modes of material nature, basically, which makes your answer not wrong. But the 3 modes, they're springing out of the different mentalities from different people, which are the different mentalities are caused by different configurations of the 3 modes of material nature. So Krishna is going to answer Uddhava's question here in somewhat of a different way, because when he said the modes of material nature are the cause of the different philosophies, he's saying that they're limited because they're springing from the modes of material nature. The philosophical conclusions are only within the 3 modes of material nature. But Krishna is going to answer this question in a different way. Lord Krishna replied, "Because all material elements are present everywhere, it is reasonable that different learned brahmanas have analyzed them in different ways. All such philosophers spoke under the shelter of my mystic potency, and thus they could say anything without contradicting the truth." So one thing is Krishna is saying that the different philosophers are speaking the philosophy, or the different, enumerating the different elements under my potency. So that's the same as the 14th chapter. But here Krishna is saying it's actually non-contradictory to the truth. There he was saying it's limited, but here he's saying it's non-contradictory to the truth. And why is he saying it's non-contradictory to the truth? Because the different enumerations are, there are different possible ways to enumerate things. Because, for example, everything comes from the one source of Krishna. So you can say that there is only one thing in existence. And then everything comes from him. So it's not incorrect to say everything comes from him. But you could also say that, because from the glance of Mahavishnu, or from the Pradhan, there is also the Mahatattva. From the Mahatattva's false ego combined with each of the three modes of material nature. So you could say that there's the Mahatattva, and there's the false ego, and goodness, passion, and ignorance. So you can say it is five. Or you can say it is just the Supreme Lord, or you can say it's Maha two, just the false ego and the Mahatattva. Because each element contains within it, in a subtle form, everything else. So depending upon what you want to describe, you can describe it in one way or another way without actually contradicting the truth. Now let me just look in here and see what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says in answer to this. Just one line of his I've noted to read. The Lord Himself empowers living entities to speculate and speak on reality in different ways. So that, Vishwanath's comment is very much parallel to what Krishna Himself said in chapter 14. So let's go on. So this section is all about this point up to verse 11. When philosophers argue, I don't choose to analyze this particular case in the same way that you have. It is simply my own insurmountable energies that are motivating their analytical disagreements. Here, Vishwanath comments, by the influence of the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, different philosophers are attracted to different views. And by the influence of the material atmosphere created by the Lord, these philosophers perpetually disagree with one another. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavatam 6.4.31, let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the all-pervading Supreme Personality of Godhead, who possesses unlimited transcendental qualities. Please listen, it's important. Acting from within the cores of the hearts of all philosophers who propagate various views, he causes them to forget their own souls, while sometimes agreeing and sometimes disagreeing amongst themselves. Thus he creates within this material world a situation in which they are unable to come to a conclusion. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. This is just a measure or another way to understand the greatness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, practically speaking. Because everyone has such different visions, different points of view, different individualistic ideas, different consciousnesses, different philosophical viewpoints, and they're all being stimulated, empowered, and verified by the Supreme Lord. And just imagine how wonderful what he has done is. Everyone has a different philosophy, and when they look at the world, they all see it. They're looking at the same world, and they're all seeing the proofs that their philosophy is correct when they look at the same world. That's quite astounding. So what a wonderful creation, what a staggeringly mysterious creation that Krishna has put together, just basically to bewilder everyone. And because the material creation is so bewildering, if we just rely on our own consciousness, because we're going to see something not reality, we're going to see something quite different from reality, therefore we need Shastra to give us vision as to which way to go, left or to go right. Otherwise our own vision will dictate what we see, and we won't be able to get an objective viewpoint, so therefore we need Shastra. There's what's that called in the quantum physics point, that's Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty or something, that that describes basically that how the viewer affects the viewed. So we don't see objectively. We will see we're only seeing our own mind, Atmavan Manyate Jagat, in that sense. So this is Krishna's potency. He sees reality. 6. By interaction of my energies, different opinions arise. But for those who have fixed their intelligence on me and control their senses, differences of perception disappear, and consequently the very cause for argument is removed, because they'll see Krishna. Oh, we'll just read Vishwanath's comment here. Conflicting perceptions in the mind of various mundane philosophers is created by the Lord's external energy. Although deluded, confused by the Lord's illusory energy, each philosopher thinks that he is correct, saying, it may be like this and it may be like that. Although such thinking is surely rational, it's certainly logical, because of a limited view of reality, each philosopher argues and counter-argues without ever coming to a definite conclusion. Such quarreling is absent in the society of devotees who accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose vision is not limited and who is not under the influence of the illusory energy. Being enlightened in the truth, the devotees of the Lord are in complete agreement. They're not in complete agreement about everything, but they're in complete agreement about the Shastra gives us the key to understanding reality. So there may be even disagreements on how to interpret one Shastric point, but ultimately everyone accepts Shastra and certainly the basic principles of life that have been given to us in Shastra. Even if by chance there appears to be some differences in opinion, this is not because the devotees are under the influence of false ego. On the transcendental platform, there are also varieties of perception according to one's particular relationship with the Lord. So that's such a wonderful point, and it's a point that Srila Prabhupada made, that the devotees are in agreement on the goal is to please Krishna, and they may, due to their individual differences, have opinions, differing opinions on how to please Krishna, and that is not due to false ego. By definition, it is not due to false ego. By definition, it is due to the individuality of the living entity. So that and that's also considered a gift of God, that particular vision, and it should be respected in others as we would like others to respect our vision. We should respect it in others. And that is the key to having proper, legitimate disagreements on how to do something, while not letting it become so dominant in the relationship that there was no relationship anymore. The key is that to keep in mind that everyone in the society of devotees is trying to please the Supreme Lord, and everyone has the same objective. And out of that, there should be born respect. This is such an important point, because when we're together, there's so many times there's disagreements about how to proceed and how to accomplish something. But the essential point that we have to remind ourselves of is that we have to respect the opinions of others. Respect them, because they're also trying to please Krishna, and Krishna has inspired them with this opinion. So if respect is kept central in the relationship, respect because they're devotees and Krishna has given them this viewpoint, and that means respect of them and their viewpoint is respect of Krishna. So if that's kept central, Krishna is kept central, then we could have the diversity of the different opinions without it completely falling apart. So if we don't have the central point of respect for Krishna and respect that this person is a sincere devotee also, if we don't have that, then we just have the diversity. And in Kali Yuga, the diversity is so strong. So we always have to keep the unity point central. And then we can allow diversity. But we can't just be unified on everything, because we're all individuals. That's quite artificial. But if we try to do that, it's very oppressive. If everyone's supposed to think exactly the same way, that's very oppressive. And if we say that everyone can do whatever they want and think anything that they want, that's what? Chaotic. It becomes chaos. So this balance of unity and diversity is difficult to maintain, but it is essential in the society of devotees. And therefore Prabhupada even said that when the devotees go to the GBC meetings, they should discuss unity and diversity. He actually said that one time. Unless you have unity, diversity just becomes chaos. And unless you have diversity, unity becomes what? Who said boring? Of course. Unity can't exist because it's too artificial. We all become one. This doesn't work like that. So, he continues. Krishna continues. The Supreme Lord continues explaining this point to Uddhav. O best amongst men, because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another, philosophers may calculate the number of basic material elements in different ways according to their personal desires. All subtle material elements are actually present within their gross effects, just like that. Where does earth come from? Which element? We've discussed this before.
Water.
So, okay. So you can say that water contains earth and water contains fragrance, but it's in a subtle, unmanifest form. So then one becomes three, or you could say that water has taste, or you could say it in four. So depending upon if you want to compress or expand the forms, you can describe them in different ways. Simple point. The example is given. There's mud, and that within, in a subtle way, the earthen pot is within the mud, unmanifest way. Or so you can describe it as one, or you could say earthen pot and mud. So then it's two. Text 9. Therefore, no matter which of these thinkers is speaking, and regardless of whether in their calculations they include material elements within their previous subtle cause or else within their subsequent manifest products, I accept their conclusions as authoritative, because a logical explanation can always be given for each of the different theories. So Krishna is taking a mood different from his explanation in the 14th chapter, he's saying each one of them is logically justifiable and acceptable. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments in this regard, even though materialistic philosophers rationally describe the universe from varying perceptions, they can never come to an ultimate understanding without hearing from the Lord or his representative. So that point is the point that Vishwanath is choosing to make, that ultimately there's the ultimate realization is to see Krishna in everything. One should therefore not be proud of his limited intelligence just because he has some partial understanding of material existence. Great wisdom. One should never be proud because one at best can only have a partial understanding. And that because only Krishna sees the ultimate. He sees everything. So one should never become proud because our understandings are only partial. Always incomplete. And not only that, but they're always a gift. Because a person who has been covered by ignorance since time immemorial is not capable of affecting his own self-realization, there must be some other personality who is in factual knowledge of the Absolute Truth and can impart this knowledge to him. So there is knowledge, the premise in this, there is knowledge of the Absolute Truth, and everyone is covered by ignorance. He cannot realize that Absolute Truth by his own power. So therefore he has to get it from outside of him, the ultimate understanding, and this is what Vishwanath was hinting at in the previous verse. And therefore there must be a person who actually has greater knowledge. So this is from 10 to 18 is Krishna's opinion, his opinion about the truth. So up to this point he was speaking about the opinions of others, and from 10 to 18 this is Krishna's opinion. The commentary on this point by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur again. Uddhava explained how some materialistic philosophers see 25 categories of elements where others see 26. Generally, this distinction is caused by a difference in spiritual understanding. Some see the individual soul and the supreme soul to be one and the same, so that they count 25, where others recognize the distinction between the one supreme Lord and the many minute living entities maintained by the one Lord, and so they count 26. The sixth dative case, grammatical point here, in this verse should be understood as the first dative case, because the conditioned souls forget their constitutional position. It is the omniscient supreme Lord who can revive their original nature by imparting to them the knowledge of the self. This is the opinion of all the Vaishnava authorities. So Krishna's opinion is going to continue. There must, because everyone is only partially aware of things. We have our own portion of reality that we understand. We live in our bubble of reality, and we tend to just live in that bubble and think that it is reality, but it actually is only part of reality. And if one accepts the part as the whole, that is illusion. So that to actually gain understanding of the totality of reality, the Absolute Truth, one needs someone outside of oneself who is in knowledge of that factual reality to reveal that actual reality to us. So 11. According to knowledge in the mode of goodness, there is no qualitative difference between the living entity and the supreme controller. So this is the kind of knowledge that one will perceive if one is infected with the mode of primarily with the mode of goodness. The imagination of qualitative difference between them is useless speculation. So this is, notice he said qualitative, not quantitative. If it was quantitative, well, there is absolutely no difference between the living entity and the supreme controller, at all, that we're moving into impersonalism, but there's no qualitative difference. And to imagine a qualitative difference is useless, because we are eternal as Krishna is eternal. Nature exists, this is 12, originally as the equilibrium of the three material modes, which pertain only to nature. So the three modes don't affect the spiritual realm, they just affect the material realm, the land of Prakriti. So there's originally equilibrium. This is the unmanifest state of material nature. And this pertains only, the modes pertain only to nature, not to the transcendental spirit soul. These modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, are the effective cause of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of this universe. So effective cause means the nimittikaran, the immediate cause of the universe. The modes push things along in the universe. So in the spiritual world, we all very well know that the modes of material nature are not active. They are the prison house keepers of the material world. They keep everyone engaged. I was thinking of this, of that point this morning, chanting japa, where, of course, during chanting japa, so many interesting thoughts come. But to actually hear the holy name of Krishna, if so many interesting thoughts are coming and you're following those interesting thoughts, you cannot hear the because that the active state of the mind is caused by the mode of passion. But rather the mind has to be peaceful. It has to be more or less inactive, not inactive in the sense of ignorance, which makes one sleepy, but inactive in the sense of absent. The mode of passion has to be absent. So what happens very often, our mind is so active and so active, when we start to chant, we can't hear anything. We can't even hear one name of Krishna. This is due to the mode of passion infecting our minds. And we should recognize it as such. And what we tend to do is think that our thoughts are so valuable that we place our consciousness on them. We tend to do this so often, and the result of that is the passion increases. Because whatever you feed will grow. And we should know clearly, in this example of chanting japa, that it won't work. We won't be able to associate with Krishna through his holy names if our mind is passionately running all over the universe and we are following it with all these interesting thoughts. And it first starts with an interesting thought, and then it just becomes one thought after the next, and it's not even interesting anymore, but you just can't stop. In the beginning there's some taste, the thrill of the intellectual platform, playing on that platform. But after a while, it's not thrilling anymore. And you can't stop. So what we recommend is stop. And the way to stop the mind is to give it a very simple task and just keep on doing that one thing, which is hearing Krishna's holy name, until the mind slows down and the consciousness begins to touch this holy sound vibration of Krishna's name. And then when it touches Krishna's name, which is a transcendental sound, it gradually becomes affected. And then as the mind slows down and becomes softened and more peaceful and more satisfied, and then it begins to actually get some transcendental benefit and transcendental taste from associating with Krishna's holy name. And then it's much easier. But then
But such a tendency, if we're habituated to the mode of passion in the mind, to start thinking it's much easier, it's much easier, it's so nice. I wish I could do this all the time. And then the mind is starting to go and go, and it gets, and then you can still listen, but then you start playing around a little more, and it's gone again. So the mind must be kept, must in the sense of if conditional clause, that if one wants to get the result of chanting japa, the mind must be kept in goodness. And that is why, one reason why, that the congregational chanting of the holy name is so much easier, is because it's more powerful. And it can attract the mind and engage the mind, even if it's not in a peaceful condition. It can, but still, when the mind is really disturbed, that even won't engage the mind. So anyway, the mode of goodness, that's what we were speaking about there. And the mode of passion, ignorance. They are so powerful, they so easily control us, but not only that, they are the effective causes of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of this universe, the entirety of the universe. And we are fighting with them. So it's no wonder that we lose the battle and are completely under their control. In this world, the mode of goodness is recognized as knowledge, the mode of passion as fruit of work, and the mode of darkness as ignorance. Time is perceived as the agitated interaction of the material modes, and the totality of functional propensity is embodied by the primeval sutra or the mahatattva, meaning we'll read the purport here. The impetus for the interaction of the material elements is the forward movement of time. Because time is passing, the embryo grows within the womb, gradually comes out, grows up, produces byproducts, dwindles and dies. All of this is due to the pushing of time. In the absence of the time factor, the material elements do not interact, but remain inert in the form of pradhan. Lord Krishna is establishing the basic categories of the material world so that the human beings can conceive of the Lord's creation. So he's giving us some ability to conceive of Krishna's, the entirety of the material creation. Were the categories not condensed, analysis and conceptualization would be impossible, since the Lord's potencies are infinite. And the sutra, in a previous verse in purport, it was described as the thread of fruit of, if I remember correctly, a thread of fruit of actions and reactions. Basically, the thread of the karma. Do you think you could find that in the Vedabase? There was a previous mention of what the sutra was. It's an aspect of the Mahatattva that threads the karma, yeah.
Just a few verses ago, Vishwanath says that there are two types of Mahatattva. Sattva gives rise to Mahatattva, and Rajas gives rise to sutra. Sutra is the Mahatattva moving already into the action mode.
Yes.
Actuated by the Rajas.
But there's a connection, specific connection between which fills out the concept even more clearly, between fruit of activities and the specific aspect of sutra. But it was from a previous chapter. It was in the BBT purport. Because this creation and this Mahatattva has been described quite a bit recently. So now, Krishna says, I have described the nine basic elements as the enjoying soul, nature's primeval manifestation of the Mahatattva, false ego, ether, air, fire, water, and earth. Wait, I want to write that down, excuse me. Just wait one moment, please.
Sri Raghavacharya explains that.
Wait. Sutra, what is it, 11?
15, 14.
Okay.
Sri Raghavacharya explains that the word sutra or thread is used to indicate that the Mahatattva sustains one's fruitive activities, just as a thread sustains a robe of jewels. Is that it?
I think so. But I think it's, there's another one as well, where it talks about the aspect. That the sutra is an aspect of the Mahatattva, if I remember correctly. And which verse was Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's comment on it?
Two aspects of Mahatattva. Yeah. Was first.
Excuse me?
11.22.1.
Okay. I want to move on. I think it's a few verses later, but I may be mistaken. So now we're reading 15. Hearing, touch, sight, smell, and taste. So this is Krishna's opinion again. Here's his explanation of the Sankhya, practically explanation of the different of how to codify and analyze the fundamental ingredients, the elements. Hearing, touch, sight, smell, and taste are the five knowledge acquiring senses. My dear Uddhava, and speech, the hands, the genitals, the anus, and the legs constitute the five working senses. The mind belongs to both these categories. Sound, touch, taste, smell, and form are the objects of the knowledge-acquiring senses, and movement, speech, excretion, and manufacture are functions of the working senses. In the beginning of the creation, nature assumes by the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, its form as the embodiment of all subtle causes and gross manifestations within the universe. All subtle and gross. This is Saga, the beginning of creation. Saga Dao. Prakriti Yasya. The beginning of material creation. It's the subtle and gross forms. So it one can look at this as a technical manual of here's a way to analyze the elements of the universe, but think of it as this whole complex universe is actually composed of these elements, complex and varied as it is, and the whole complex and varied universe is constructed just in the way that Krishna is describing, that there's a subtle substance at the beginning of creation that contains all the gross and subtle things that are existing within the universe. And the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not enter the interaction of material manifestation, but he merely from a distance glances upon nature. So he doesn't take direct part in the creation. Just by his glance, and that glance is? Yes, Shambhu Shiva. The glance is also known as Sadashiva, yes? Yes? Because Sadashiva is Vishnu, so the position of Lord Shiva is quite difficult to understand because he's a via media. He's coming from the fully transcendental, but it's the media of touching the material world. So the fully transcendental itself doesn't touch the material world, but this media coming from him is used to directly touch the material world. So is the intermediary that's coming from the fully spiritual but touching the material, is it material or is it spiritual? So it's somewhere in between. And the example, of course, that Lord Brahma gives is yogurt. It's milk, but it's not milk. It's its own substance. So Lord Shiva is similarly its own substance. So these different tattvas that are intermediate between spirit and matter are very difficult to understand. Lord Shiva, the Dham, Guru Tattva, they're all
junction boxes, the junctions between the spiritual and the material. The Holy Dham is another one. Very difficult to understand the Holy Dham. As soon as you start walking around and saying, oh, so everything here is so wonderful and spiritual, then some pig will throw you and some knock you over or something on. You see all the plastic bags and all the loud music and the billboards advertising luxury apartments for sale so you can enjoy your spiritual life to the fullest extent. So very mysterious, this Vrindavan Dham, the deity. Very, very mysterious. Very mysterious. As the material elements headed by the Mahatattva are transformed, they receive their specific potencies from the glance of the Supreme Lord. So at every step, the Lord his potencies are required to push along the creation. And being amalgamated by the power of nature, being combined by the power of nature, they create the universal egg, the elements. So all these elements that have been described, they come together to create an egg-like form, anandam, that the whole universe is within. So here's opinions of other philosophers on this. According to some philosophers, there are seven elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, and ether, along with their conscious, with the conscious spirit soul and the supreme soul, who is the basis of both the material elements and the ordinary spirit soul. So okay, if there was an examination and the question was asked, the conscious spirit soul and the supreme soul, who is the basis of both the material elements and the ordinary spirit soul. So if the examination question, it says, which is the ordinary spirit soul? What is an ordinary spirit soul? What would you answer? I'll give you a hint. The one that's not the supreme spirit soul is the ordinary one. That's me. And he is the extraordinary spirit soul. No one likes to think, oh, anyway, you're just an ordinary spirit soul. Especially, no one likes to think like that. But indeed, we are not only ordinary, but we're insignificant also. More insulting. But that's reality. According to this theory, the body, senses, life, air, and all material phenomena are produced from these seven elements. These are different ways of explaining, as Krishna explained it before. Other philosophers state that there are six elements, the five physical elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, and the sixth element, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So what are we dealing with here? I think you're all asking yourself that question also. What are we dealing with? This is Sankhya. Sankhya means counting. It means that different ways to analyze the fundamental principles of material existence. So what is the purpose of this? Should we talk about that now or should we wait till the end? Yeah, and also, especially to understand that actually, even though we're ordinary spirit souls, we have nothing to do with this universe. This is the basic point, to count the elements. So the earth, this is a transformation of earth. This is a transformation of earth. And more astoundingly even, this is a transformation of earth. And it's a transformation of fire is also in there. And ether is in there. And the different airs are in there. And this is a completely different element. All these things in existence, there's some of the fire element appearing. All these different things in existence on the material level, they have nothing to do with the spirit soul. You can calculate them as 28 or 29 or 27 or 9 or 7 or 16 or however you want to calculate them, but they have nothing to do with me. The soul who is not of the material world is not a fundamental building block, foundational ingredient of material existence. I, the spirit soul, am completely separate, and therefore I shouldn't entangle myself in the material world through the mind, which is the central figure in both the working senses and the knowledge acquiring senses. The mind, did you notice that the mind is the central figure in both? So through the mind, our senses become entangled in this configuration that the philosophers, what are they doing? Some are saying 16, others are saying, no, 26. So, no, 25. Here's my reasoning. No, it's 6, and here's my reasoning. No, it's 9, and here's my reasoning. And everyone, not everyone, but they're so engaged in the philosophical arguments or practical philosophy. It's like this, this is what happened, no, this is what happened. That everyone misses the point that they have nothing to do with anything that's happening here. And this entangling tendency, this argumentative tendency, just entangles one more deeply and further where we should not be. It's another taste for the mind to relish. That's all it is. That's all we're getting entangled in. Passion and ignorance, then we have such a disagreement, we get so angry with the person because of the mode of passion, turning into the mode of ignorance, then we want to kill them, or at least teach them a good lesson. Do they have that expression in Hindi? Or teach them a good lesson, something like that, meaning beat them up, you know? In English, in American English, we'll teach them a lesson. But of course, by beating someone, you don't teach them a lesson. But that's the mode of ignorance. So when one has more in the mode of goodness, one can argue and keep respect. But when one has the mode of so much passion, then you argue on these things which are non-essential, and you get angry. Goes to ignorance. And then so entangled. And the whole point of these philosophical discussions or this counting type of discussions is to disentangle the soul from the material world. Convince him that actually he doesn't have anything to do with the material world. That he's a separate entity. He's spirit. And this world is different forms, subtle and gross, of matter. And therefore, this point will be brought to its conclusion in the next chapter. Is the Avanti Brahmana, who's going to disentangle himself completely. He's just going to say, I don't care. Let whatever is going to happen, happen. I just don't care anymore. Let the material world fall on my head, let people beat me, let people take my food, let people give me food, let people curse me, let people praise me. I don't care anymore because I don't have anything to do with this place. Whether they're telling me I'm great or telling me I'm terrible, being great and being terrible in this world are both the same. They're both illusion because I'm not in this world. I'm not of this world. I'm not in this world. I don't have a real relationship with this world. I have a relationship with Krishna. So therefore, this Sankhya philosophy is being described for the purpose of detachment.
So when we ask, so we're going to trick everyone on the examination, we're going to ask how many material elements there are, and whatever you say, we'll say, no, it's wrong. And we'll see if we can entangle anyone with disagreeing with us. Some calculate the existence of 17 basic elements, namely the 5 gross elements and the 5 objects of perception, the 5 sensory organs, the mind, and the soul as the 17th element. According to the calculation of 16 elements, so there's 16, 17, 4, 9, 1. According to the calculation of the 16, the only difference from the previous theory is that the soul is identified with the mind. So someone will say, the 16, because the soul is identified with the mind. And someone will say, no, the 17, the soul and the mind are separate. No, the 16, the soul and the mind are the same. No, the soul and the mind are separate. Separate, same. And this way, I mean, it sounds so silly, but tell me that you don't do these things sometimes, you know, just little things entangle us in Maya. In Maya meaning misidentification with that which we are not. Counting 11, there's also a way to figure it out from the point of view of 11. There's the soul, the gross elements, the senses, 8 gross and subtle elements, plus the Supreme Lord would make 9. Thus great philosophers, 25, have analyzed the material elements in many different ways. And Krishna says, all of their proposals are reasonable. Since they were all presented with ample logic, indeed such philosophical brilliance is expected of the truly learned. Maybe there's a little Parokshavad in there. I mean, he's giving practical how to deal with people in this world. You know, all these, yes, have such a brilliant argument and so logically put together and so refined. One would expect it from such a wonderful person like you. Now can we talk about something else? So Krishna says, okay, look what he does. He gives them their brilliance. Just imagine if he said, such philosophers, all the proposals are reasonable since they're presented with ample logic. Indeed, such philosophical ordinariness is expected of the truly ordinary. Then everyone says, I'm not ordinary. And like this, you know, I'll show you how I'm not ordinary. I'm extraordinary. And watch this, and watch this, and I'll do this, and I'll figure this out. I'll give you a theory you never even heard of before. But he said, this is brilliant. This is exceptionally wonderful. So Uddhava, after hearing this, says that I think it's time for our break. Now he didn't say that, I said that. Because it's just exactly 12 o'clock. So why don't we honor the break? Just when we were beginning to get excited about it all. It's so interesting, though, because in that one, Krishna, he was saying, they're all brilliant and they're all basically, here's my opinion, but every way of looking at it is great, is correct. Because after all, the different elements are within each other. The subtle are always in the gross, because the earth comes from the water and the water comes from fire, and the fire and the proof of the water coming from fire is when you burn something, there's always evaporative water coming from, and they all are included in the. And if the element is there, then the object, the sense object of the element, and the sense is there, and things like that. So Krishna just says, "Okay, it's all okay." But in the next question that Uddhava asks about the differences. Krishna's going to make it very clear that there is a distinct difference between the two things that Uddhava is going to ask about. No, we won't start now. Otherwise, we'll just go to 1 o'clock. So we'll stop here, but please come at exactly 12:35. And we shall continue with Krishna.
He just is wanting to make the point that Krishna just doesn't say everything's okay. He's going to make a clear distinction between two different ways of looking at things. Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Krishna Bhagavatam ki jai.